from NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. Haitian President Jovenel Moïse has been assassinated in his home in Port-au-Prince. He was shot dead. His wife, First Lady Martine Moïse, was also shot. There are conflicting reports about her condition. The news was confirmed by the country's acting prime minister, Claude Joseph. For more, we're joined by NPR's Carrie Kahn, who's been covering the news from Mexico City. Hi, Carrie.
Good morning.
What do we know about what happened this morning?
Sorry, good afternoon. It's been a long morning, definitely. Yes. This happened about 1 a.m. Haitian time, that's Eastern Standard Time. A group of heavily armed men attacked the presidential residency, went in and shot the president. What we have seen videos that have been circulating about the attack from a neighbor's cameras. And what is most stunning is that you hear the people talking in Spanish, and you actually do hear some English, too. And those videos have been identified as from the neighbors. And they saw actually when the attack happened. As you said, the First Lady was taken to a local hospital.
Do we know anything about a potential motive here behind this assassination, including a possible coup attempt?
It's too soon to say right now. I was just listening to a press conference with Haiti's ambassador to the U.S., Beauchide Edmond, and he did mention that the First Lady has survived the attack. That's the information that he has, and that she is getting ready or is being transported to a Miami hospital at this time. But he was quick to warn that it is too soon to talk about potential motives. He kept repeating, and we've heard that from Haitian officials, that these people were speaking in Spanish. And so that is unusual, considering that the language in Haiti is French or Creole. Mm. And so there's concern about who these assassins were and how they got out of the country. He said the airports have been closed and possibly they snuck across the border into the Dominican Republic. But as a potential motive, the president, Jovenel Moïse, had enough enemies, political enemies. The political situation in Haiti has been in turmoil for months, some would say years, over a lot of instances, but mostly because many of his political opponents believe he is not valid in his term. It's an illegitimate presidency. He was elected in 2016, but he did not take office until 2017. And so each term is a 5-year term. So his opponents say he is out of office in 2021, this year. Mm-hmm. But because there had been such a delay in him actually taking office, because those elections were marred by controversy and allegations of corruption, he says that he didn't start until 2017, so his rule is extended to 2022. And so that has been a constitutional question and such a difficult situation in Haiti for quite a long time. And there are plenty of opponents that believe he had been illegitimate in holding office this long. Hmm.
President Biden condemned the assassination today. He called it a heinous act. In a statement, he said, quote, "We stand ready to assist as we continue to work for a safe and secure Haiti." How has the rest of the international community responded, Carrie?
Well, condolences have been flooding in from all over the place. I'm here in Mexico. We've been getting from the president, the foreign minister. Everybody has sent condolences. This has been shock throughout the region, especially in the Caribbean, that a sitting president would be assassinated by foreign mercenaries, it appears to be. So there's shock and there is just an outpouring of condolences. There's also a question about the stability of Haiti at this time and what will happen in the aftermath of this. The Haiti's ambassador to the U.S. in this call that I was just on was saying that they have asked the U.S. for assistance. He did not specify exactly what that assistance would be, but he says they have been asking for the last 6 months and help with the security situation in Haiti that had deteriorated greatly in the last few months. Gangs in the country control great swaths of the capital and very important points in Haiti, and that had been a big problem. The Haitian ambassador also did say something interesting that I did not know. He said that the President Moise had recently given an interview to a Spanish language outlet where he said he had received threats and that he feared for his life. I had not heard that before.
Well, the president's death was confirmed by the acting prime minister, Claude Joseph, who Moise replaced just a couple of days ago, as you mentioned. What did you make of that?
Yeah, this is also, I hate to say it, but this is a situation in Haiti where who is in charge is always confusing. Many times very confusing. Right now, the new appointed prime minister was set to take power today. But now what is going to happen? So there is no clear path on constitutionally what happens, although I'm sure people will disagree about that. So the Haitian ambassador to the U.S. said there is discussions going on and they're trying to figure out what will happen. But at this time, Claude Joseph, the acting prime minister, is in charge of the country right now.
And he's left to lead the country at this point, I guess.
Well, we'll have to see what happens because, as I said, the new prime minister was set to take power at this time, at today sometime. So it's confusing. We'll have to see. But I think the main issue and the main point that everybody's worried about is the security situation in the country right now.
We'll continue to watch. NPR's Carrie Kahn reporting from Mexico City. Carrie, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, anyone who collected unemployment benefits this year could be eligible for low-cost or even free health insurance plans through the Affordable Care Act. This benefit is part of the nearly $2 trillion American Rescue Plan that President Biden signed into law back in March. Joining us now is Larry Levitt. He is Executive Vice President for Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Larry, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, in fact, quite a few people have gotten unemployment benefits in 2021. So tell me more about this program and who would be eligible for it.
Yeah, this was something that was created as part of the COVID relief package, the American Rescue Plan. And what it does is it automatically makes people who received any unemployment benefits in 2021 eligible for zero premium health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. And this is, you know, generous insurance because it also provides lower deductibles, lower copays. So there are a lot of people out there who may be uninsured and eligible for help that they might not know about.
Do we have any idea how many people?
Well, I mean, millions of people have gotten unemployment benefits, as you said. The estimates of how many people will take advantage of this are pretty low. The Congressional Budget Office projected that about 500,000 uninsured people would end up getting this help during 2021. But that's just a projection. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who could benefit from this help if they know about it.
It certainly sounds like it would help. How long would it last?
So this is a short-term program. It would last until the end of the calendar year. And people do have a short window now to sign up before August 15th during a special enrollment period that the Biden administration created in response to the pandemic. But there are a lot of people out there who are also eligible for help and may continue to be eligible next year. I mean, anyone whose income is below 1.5 times the poverty level. That's about $30,000 a year for a family of three, a little over $30,000. They're also eligible for zero premium health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. There are over 7 million people who are eligible for Medicaid but are uninsured, so have not signed up. So, you know, over half the people who are uninsured are eligible for help either through the Affordable Care Act or Medicaid. They just may not know that help is there.
If we could zoom out for just a minute, President Biden has extended open enrollment in the ACA since he's come into office because of the pandemic. How has that affected enrollment in the program over the last few months?
Well, you know, over 1 million people have signed up in this special enrollment period that President Biden created. And it's, you know, it's a whole bunch of things the Biden administration has done to really pull out all the stops to get people covered during the pandemic, during the economic crisis. It's extending this enrollment period. It's offering this new help for people who are unemployed. It's increasing the premium help available under the Affordable Care Act this year and next year, and they hope to make that permanent. They've also reversed the cuts in outreach and community-based navigators to help people sign up. So, you know, this is really a sea change from what we saw under the Trump administration, which was efforts to limit the Affordable Care Act, limit Medicaid, and make it harder for people to get insured.
Well, exactly. And the law was under threat for years. Just last month, the U.S. Supreme Court preserved it again. Do you think the ACA is finally on solid ground? Is it here to stay?
There's little question in my mind that the ACA is here to stay for the foreseeable future at this point. You know, the legal cloud that's been hanging over it for a decade has now been lifted. You know, Republicans tried to repeal and replace the ACA during the Trump administration and failed. And I think there's little taste among ACA opponents to try that again in any serious way. And there's a president who campaigned on reinvigorating the ACA. I mean, if there is any political leader out there right now, maybe with the exception of former President Obama, it is President Biden, who is so closely associated with the ACA.
Larry Levitt is Executive Vice President for Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It has been relatively quiet on the political front as of late, which is newsworthy in its own way. President Biden is in Illinois today. He's trying to sell his human infrastructure plan, the one that includes child care and workforce development. A deal to rebuild roads and bridges is still languishing. And in Congress, both parties are gearing up for the select committee to investigate the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. And Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy does have some pretty big decisions ahead. Which Republicans should serve on it? Our political strategists join us now. Alice Stewart is a Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Peter. Great to be with you.
Good to have you. And Bill Press, it is good to have you. You are our Democrat today.
Thank you, Peter. It's good to be here. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Bill.
All right, so let's get into this. CNN and Politico are reporting that Kevin McCarthy is going to name some Republicans to the January 6th committee. He could have chosen not to. Alice, do you think cooperation is the right move?
It absolutely is. I think a buy-in is much better than a boycott with regard to this January 6th commission. And a Politico piece this morning mentioned, I think an important question is, will McCarthy go the rabble-rouser route, or will he pick steady voices that can go head-to-head with Democrats? And I would be all in on a steady voice, someone that is going to look at the facts and just the facts and get to the bottom of this, which is important. I think there's also some concern on the other side in terms of how Nancy Pelosi has set this up to date, is it seems to be built on a predetermined conclusion rather than a path to conclusion. And I think we need to make sure this is a path guided by facts and facts
alone.
What
do you mean by that? What do you mean by that?
There has been so much put out there and spoken about, we know exactly what happened and exactly who was to blame, and putting a lot of the emphasis on the former president, which I do believe he does have culpability in this. But we cannot assume the outcome based on what we know right now. And we cannot put people on this panel that clearly have a predetermined outcome about their decision. So I think it's important to put, as I said, on both sides, steady, level-headed people that will have a bipartisan look at the facts and just the facts. And that includes giving Republicans the opportunities, just as Democrats, to call witnesses, hire staff, and ask the questions.
Well, Bill, I hear you there. I know you want to talk. The thinking is that McCarthy doesn't want Democrats to control the narrative and the news cycle. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think we have to stop the finger pointing about the committee before it's even formed. I mean, yes, there are some people who say Donald Trump, ignited this whole thing. There are Republicans who say, hey, it was just another day of tourists roaming the Capitol. So forget those people. We need the select committee. Absolutely. I agree. Other than that, with everything that Alice said, we have to get to the bottom of this. This was an insurrection to overthrow the United States government. We cannot, de-emphasize what happened on that day. We got to get to the bottom of it. And the only way to do Kevin McCarthy could have had a bipartisan commission. So he kind of made his own mess here, but he walked away from that after appointing John Katko to make a deal with Benny Thompson. He walked away from that deal. So now he's stuck with a select committee. It's very, very important that both parties participate. It's very important, I agree with Alice, that Kevin McCarthy ignore the hotheads like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz or Jim Jordan and put on some good, strong, outspoken, reasonable Republicans to represent their side and get this thing wrapped up by the end of the year so we can move on.
Okay, actually, that leads me to my final question on this issue before we move on, is sort of like, what should we be prepared for here? How long will this play out? How contentious will it be? And how important will it be for Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats and Kevin McCarthy and the Republicans? And I'll throw that out to either one of you.
Well, I'll just jump in. Go ahead.
Now, just one point. Obviously, there's currently an investigation going on from the FBI and the Judicial Department on this, and evidence from that will be coming out simultaneously. So I think it's important to move expeditiously on setting up this panel and moving forward, but also keeping in mind there's the opportunity to glean information from ongoing investigations that will help part of this. I just hope that this is done and completed before we get into the midterm elections, because this is not what we need to be focusing on. We need to be focusing on policies and not this tragedy on January 6th.
Bill, give it a crack, and we'll move on.
Yeah, I just say very, very quickly, look, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, after 9/11, there's a national commission to get to the bottom of it. This is equally important. I think it's very important that it be wrapped up by the end of the year. There's no reason they cannot do it. And I think this will be extremely critical for both Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy going into 2022 to show the world that for one time we can put politics aside and unite in saving our democracy.
Let's see what you both think of the stories that have been circulating about the past week or so. Staffing dissent, departures in Vice President Kamala Harris's office. Bill, this growing pains, leaks for political gain, is it something more concerning to you?
I think there's something else going on. Yeah, there are growing pains, and I'm sure there are some staffing problems that have leaked out. But what I find interesting, Peter, is that Republicans have tried to villainize Joe Biden, and they really have had a hard time doing it. So I think they've given up on making Biden the villain, and they're trying to now turning to Kamala Harris, who, as a woman, as an African-American, is kind of an easy target. As a Californian, let me just say, it's clear, number one, that Kamala Harris is a very key, important part of the Joe Biden team. She's involved in every decision, every major event. She's like Joe Biden was with Obama. She has the last word in any decision making in the Oval Office. And as a Californian now, I would just say those who try to sell Kamala Harris short are making a big mistake. She was the first woman district attorney of San Francisco, excelled at it. First woman attorney general of California, excelled at it. The first African-American woman representing California in the United States Senate, did a great job. Don't sell her short as vice president of the United States.
Well, Alice, she also has a lot on her plate. She's dealing with voting rights, with vaccines, with immigration. I know Republicans like to remind her of that. How do they see how the vice president is doing?
From a political standpoint, there are concerns. And look, to what Bill said, I agree with a lot of what he said. And it's clear, having worked in an administration, in any administration, you will always have people on the outside who think they belong on the inside, who want to turn things upside down. And that's what we have here. And I will give her somewhat of a pass on a lot of this, because I could care less about the palace intrigue in the VP's office, but I am concerned about the policies. And to your question, Peter, I think she has not stepped up to the plate and addressed the issues at the border with regard to immigration, which she is tasked with. I disagree with her handling and the hypocrisy with regard to defund the police and her all-in support of the human infrastructure and the progressive wish list. The policies that she is working to implement and trying to accomplish, that is where Republicans have the issue. We don't care about the goings-on in her office, but we do care about the policies that she's trying to implement.
All right. Well, President Biden spoke yesterday, just hours before the CDC announced that the Delta variant is now making up about half of the infections, the new infections in this country. Only 47% of the country is vaccinated. He pleaded with people to get their shots. Here he is.
Do it now for yourself and the people you care about, for your neighborhood, for your country. It sounds corny, but it's a patriotic thing to do.
Alice, can Biden or really anyone at this point depoliticize the vaccine issue? At this point,
it will be tough. Look, this is a healthcare issue. It's not a political issue. I would encourage everyone to go get a vaccine. The problem is we have many people in this country that don't think Joe Biden is the duly elected president and they won't listen to him. But I pray that they listen to healthcare experts and do the right thing and get their vaccination.
Bill, do you have common ground on this one as well?
Well, we certainly do, and that this is not a political issue, should not be a political issue. Masks are not political. Vaccinations are not political. I think, in response to your question, Peter, I think if anybody can do it, Joe Biden can, because he's just pleading with people to do what's best for themselves, for their family, and for their friends. Notice, and I hope he gets credit for this, he's not saying, we're going to have any new law, no new government mandate, no new required passport or anything. We're just saying, be the best that you can be. He's appealing to Americans at that level, and I just hope they respond.
Yeah, I have less than a minute and a half here, but I want to give you both an opportunity here to weigh in on something. I mentioned it was kind of a quiet week in politics. I mean, just listen to us, how even and tempered and mild everyone's been. what's on your mind right now? Sort of as we have a moment to breathe and look ahead. Alice, you start, and then Bill. What are you looking forward to here in the next couple of weeks?
Well, obviously, I look forward to the legal battle that President Trump has just started with the high-tech Facebook and Googles and the internet groups. Look, I think that they did infringe on his free speech, but having people pay for his legal bills, I think, is a bridge too far. But this is going to be dominating his headlines for the next several weeks and months.
Okay, that's a good one. Bill, you're up.
Well, Peter, I'm going to go non-political here because of the story that I've been intrigued with this week and really disappointed in is Sha'Carri Richardson, this great sprinter who's not going to be able to compete and for us, representing us in the Olympics because she smoked a joint. Give me a freaking break. Smoking a joint does not make you run faster.
Yeah. Bill Press and Al Stewart, thanks so much.
Three years ago, a man with a grudge murdered five people at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Maryland. And now, finally, his trial has started. What we wanted to know was, how did the staff who survived the shooting keep going? Find out in our Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded podcast.
The first wave of books looking back at the Trump presidency are out. In the excerpts, we hear how gravely ill Trump was with COVID-19 and the blunt assessment from former Attorney General William Barr about Trump's false claims of a rigged election. But the challenge of recounting this chapter of history goes well beyond digging up juicy anecdotes. Here's a re-airing of a report by NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben.
When The Wall Street Journal's Michael Bender wrote his book about Trump's 2020 defeat, one section stuck out as the most difficult, telling the story of what Bender dubbed Hell Week and a Half.
It was the 10 days in 2020 that started with the super spreader event in the Rose Garden, included Trump's disastrous debate with Joe Biden in Cleveland, and then Trump himself obviously testing positive for COVID a few days later.
It's not just that it was a lot to fold together. It's that simply figuring out what happened was maddening.
How early he tested positive, how sick he was during that time. I mean, these are serious questions with national security implications that very few people knew or had firsthand knowledge of. And I had competing versions from senior officials, serious people, who all were telling me different versions of that story.
That struggle, Bender explains, is itself emblematic of the Trump administration.
The deception wasn't just with the public. It was literally from person to person inside the West Wing. And that's the story, not necessarily worrying about exactly what happened.
Bender's book, Frankly, We Did Win This Election, is one of many trying to pull order from Trump's chaos. Another nightmare scenario comes from The Washington Post's Yasmin Abu Talib and Damian Paletta about Trump and COVID. Abu Talib agreed that it was hard to discern the truth from dozens of conflicting stories, which made it all the more striking when they did find consensus on the White House's coronavirus response.
Of the more than 180 people we spoke to, there wasn't a single one who defended the collective response.
According to Princeton presidential historian Julian Zelizer, telling the story of the Trump White House means not just recounting newsmaking moments. The racist statements, the allegations of sexual assault, the impeachments, plural, but making sense of it.
Why did America's political system have room for so much chaos over a four-year period, which is like this big puzzle I don't think everyone's totally grappled with?
And it's not just journalists and historians. Trump administration insiders will try to explain their place in history. That's according to Keith Urban, a co-founder of Javelin, a literary agency that represented Bender, former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton, and former FBI Director James Comey, with more to come.
I think it does require for people who worked in the Trump presidency to wrestle with some of the moral compromises that they had to make by serving in that administration.
Writing the history of a leaky, live-tweeted presidency has been unusual for a variety of additional reasons. There's book industry tumult. Simon & Schuster employees protested the publishing giants printing Mike Pence's book. In addition, Trump could still run for president again, which may be why he has given at least 22 book interviews, as Axios recently reported. There was also a Trump-era boom in political book sales. Now, however, those sales are down 60% from the second half of 2020, according to market research firm NPD. But that doesn't mean interest will disappear, according to Javelin co-founder Matt Latimer.
For example, next year there are a dozen or more books coming out about President Nixon. I mean, I think long after we're all gone, people are still going to be trying to figure out what the hell this is all about.
It's been 47 years since Nixon resigned. By that same math, we'll be reading new Trump books into the late 2060s, and probably beyond. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones is going to Howard University. The New York Times reporter and creator of the 1619 Project will be the new Knight Chair in Race and Reporting at the revered historically black college. Her decision comes after her alma mater, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, denied her tenure, prompting an outcry that the decision was based on her race and gender. Nicole Hannah-Jones joins us now. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on your new position at Howard University. What's the message you're sending with your decision to go to Howard after the very public tenure controversy at UNC?
So I, of course, love the University of North Carolina. I was very excited to return back to my alma mater, the place that really launched my journalism career, and to teach there. But I was denied initially the vote on tenure by the Board of Trustees, which are politically appointed by the Republican legislature. And it became a very kind of ugly and public battle where political appointees were not voting on my credentials, but because of political reasons. They didn't like the nature of my work. And I just decided, you know, at the age of 45, having worked myself through the ranks of my profession, having achieved a very high level of success in my profession, that I was just unwilling to keep fighting that battle, that I really wanted to take my talents and the resources I could bring and bring them to an institution that was actually built for Black uplift and Black excellence, that wasn't built in opposition to the work that I want to do and me as a human being.
Since the 1980s, nobody had ever been denied tenure at UNC in the position you were offered. You talked about this political process. Did anyone at the university tell you why they didn't offer you tenure?
No, and this was also part of my decision making. You know, I understand that the political situation around the University of North Carolina has not been good for about a decade now. And it's one thing when political appointees interfere in the process, But it would have been something else had the leadership of the university, namely the chancellor and the provost, spoke out publicly and demanded that I be treated like every other night chair, all of them who were white before me. And that didn't happen. And not only did they not publicly speak up, but privately, they were not transparent with me about why I didn't have my 10-year package voted on in November when it was supposed to have been voted on the first time, or in January. And to this day, no one in leadership at the university has explained to me what happened and why I was treated differently than everyone else who had come before me.
You talked about you're an alum of UNC. You talked about how much you love it there. You love the Tar Heels. This lack of transparency, obviously, was difficult. How did it feel to go through that process?
You know, it was humiliating. I didn't speak out about what happened to me. I didn't want everyone to know that I was the first night chair in the history of that position to be denied tenure. So it was humiliating personally, professionally. To be treated that way by your alma mater, the same university that had just a few months earlier inducted me into its Media and Journalism Hall of Fame. It was painful because I've tried to give back to that university as much as possible. And I really just saw my decision to go there as giving back further. And it was enraging because, you know, I've spent my career writing about inequality, about racial discrimination, about how Black Americans are often not treated fairly by American institutions, and then to become kind of so blatantly subjected to that same treatment was enraging.
I want to read something you wrote in a statement published on the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's website. You write, "Since the second grade, when I began being bused into white schools, I've been fighting against people who did not think a Black girl like me belonged. People who tried to control what I did, how I spoke, how I looked, and the work I produced," end quote. To your mind, simply put, was your experience at Chapel Hill much different than that?
No, it was this experience that made me decide I just wasn't going to subject myself to people like that having any more decisions about my career or my life. And I've been subjected to that my entire life. And I think a lot of times Black Americans feel that we have to go into elite white institutions to prove our worthiness, that if we can succeed there, that becomes a symbol that we are smart enough and good enough and that we've worked hard enough. And I've certainly done that myself, but I think we have to eventually refuse to keep doing that, to keep letting someone else determine another community and other institutions outside of ourselves determine our worthiness. And I'm refusing to do that any longer.
Let me ask you for a moment, Nicole, about the backlash you received after publishing the 1619 Project, which, of course, you did for the New York Times. That looked at the role of slavery and how that played in building American capitalism and democracy. And while it was widely acclaimed, some scholars argued that you injected ideology into the history. Were you surprised by that kind of pushback?
No, I wasn't surprised. The entire reason that the 1619 Project had to exist in the first place is because we have not wanted to deal with this as a society. And frankly, the field of history has tended to downplay the role of slavery and racism in America and its institutions. You know, for the last 3 to 4 decades, more progressive white scholars and large numbers of Black scholars have been pushing back against what was another ideological version of history that really sought to bolster this idea of American exceptionalism. So when you create a project that is mainstream public history that goes viral the way the 1619 Project did, of course you expect that there is going to be pushback to that. He who controls the narrative controls the actions and the policies that get set. And we are seeing a strong pushback from people who would prefer the status quo, which is that we deny how inequality is structured into our society. And if you deny that, then you don't pass policies to fix it.
Nicole Hannah-Jones at Howard University, you will be starting a Center for Journalism and Democracy. Tell us what your vision there is moving forward.
Absolutely. I feel that we are in a very dangerous moment in our democracy where we're seeing efforts to really erode our free speech, where we're seeing efforts to erode our voting protections, kind of the most fundamental right you have in a democracy is the right to vote. But yet, I don't think our political reporting is really rising to the moment. Too many of our political reporters, I think, believe, because of their experiences as part of the majority in this country, that our democracy will hold, that our institutions will self-correct, and that we should just cover politics as kind of a both sides narrative or horse race. But that's not what's happening. And we are in a very dangerous period if the media does not act as the firewall for our democracy.
Well, to wrap up here, Nicole Hannah-Jones, after your experience at UNC, you wrote, quote, "The burden of working for racial justice is laid on the very people bearing the brunt of the injustice and not the powerful people who maintain it. I say to you, I refuse." What is the lesson from your experience for the Board of Trustees at UNC and for students there and everywhere?
Thank you for asking that. Walking away from the University of North Carolina was a very difficult decision. I understand what it would mean for someone like myself to be on campus, for students and for faculty, and for the very necessary work that the university has to do. But I also think that it is fundamentally unfair that the people who have suffered the injustice are continuously asked to remain in institutions that they will have to fight for basic fair treatment, and that we should be charged with healing and fixing the problems that people in power have created. I wanted to send the message that that obligation lies with the Board of Trustees, with the university's leadership, and with the state legislature that has such a powerful role in determining the future of that university. It is time for the people who have power to take responsibility for the structures that they uphold. And if there's going to be true healing, it cannot be based on the sacrifice of those who have already sacrificed so much.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is the new Knight Chair in Race and Reporting at Howard University and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times Magazine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Last year, health professionals were concerned about what the pandemic would mean for people who needed organ transplants to survive. Of course, many hospitals were weighed down with COVID patients, and many transplants had to be put on hold. But in the end, the number of transplants performed last year in the United States was just about equal to the year before that, around 39,000. So how did it happen? How did all those transplants get done in a pandemic? Reporter Liz Cooney has been covering this for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Liz, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And before we get to that question, take us back to the start of the pandemic when many people thought that this would be a much bigger issue. How many transplants were put off, and what was happening exactly?
About a year ago, in mid-March, donations had nosedived by more than a third. So if you figure that you just mentioned, if there are 39,000 a year, that's a pretty big dive. And then slowly, as the pandemic's grip changed across the country, some of those people who had to wait actually were able to proceed with their transplants. Unfortunately, not everyone can wait, but there was some hopeful outcome for some people who could wait.
Right. So apparently doctors were able to catch up with the backlog. And we know now that the number of transplants more or less held steady in 2020. So why is that? Why the turnaround?
There was a turnaround because the pandemic hit different places at different times with different severity. When we looked at a year ago, as you said, that was when things were particularly bad in the Northeast. New York City was the epicenter. New England was hit very hard. That was when people didn't know very much about the virus. There wasn't enough in the way of PPE to protect healthcare workers or patients. And so what happened was that there was a big problem in that part of the country, but other parts of the country weren't hit quite so hard. And there is a national system that has people put on a waiting list, and some of the organizations that are involved with talking to donor families after their loved one has died were able to head to different parts of the country and accomplish what they needed to do to help people who were waiting for organs in parts of the country that were pretty much nearly paralyzed by COVID.
And on the other hand, according to your reporting, more people did die last year while they were waiting for a transplant. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. There was a problem on the wait list. People who were waiting for donors or for transplants that didn't happen. There were more than 7,000 deaths in 2020, and that compares to more than 5,000 deaths in 2019. So there were some people who were not able to be helped by even this effort to bring the organs to people who needed them.
So who was donating organs during the pandemic? I'm sure that many people didn't want to donate if it meant they had to be in a hospital while the virus was raging.
Yes, that would be people who could donate. They're called living donors, meaning that a person can donate part of their liver to someone else and it could help them. And we have two kidneys. A person could donate one kidney to a loved one or another person in need. But that operation, of course, is exposing a healthy person to risk. But at a time when there's COVID in the hospital where this gift would take place, that's been considered ethically a problem. So there was a drop in the number of living donors. Again, comparing 2020 to the year before, there was a drop of almost a couple of thousand in those operations. That just didn't happen. It have resumed, but in the height of the pandemic, that was something that was not going forward.
Your reporting also pointed out something that I think is worth noting. COVID, as we know, can cause long-term damage to people, including the organs, the liver, the lungs. How do you think that might affect the demand for transplants in the months and years ahead?
Some of the doctors I spoke to are quite concerned about this, that we seem to be moving out of the isolation and the lockdown that we all experienced to one degree or another last year, but it's had ramifications for people with alcohol use disorder or other problems that would affect, say, the liver. They're also...
Oh, because people are drinking more.
Because people are drinking more. They've lost the resources they might have had to deal with their alcohol use disorder. Think about the things that might work, therapy or meetings or other, if you've lost your job, other social supports that might be helpful, I'm told, pretty much disappeared. There are also some concerns that we may not be eating such healthful food as we might want to in isolation or because it's been harder to leave our homes or for any number of reasons. Healthful food might not have been as available, and there are concerns that changes in diet could also be damaging to organs like a liver.
Liz Cooney, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now.